for Monday, June 26, 2006, this is Free Speech Radio News. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado. Senate Democrats hold investigative hearings on weapons of mass destruction claims. People around the nation weigh in on real solutions to domestic and international energy problems. Mauritanians vote in a referendum to end decades of coup attempts and one-party rule. But first, these headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the Free Speech Radio News headlines. East Timor's Prime Minister Mariel Katiri said today that he is ready to resign. The announcement marks the end of a political showdown between Al-Katiri and President Xanana Gusmão, who on Thursday had threatened to resign if the Prime Minister did not leave office. Al-Katiri's decision to fire some 600 disgruntled soldiers earlier this year is widely seen as the catalyst for the country's current political crisis. Fretilin, the Prime Minister's political party, will name his replacement. A powerful bomb exploded near Sri Lanka's capital today while Norwegian diplomats were busy organizing an upcoming meeting with Nordic nations to decide the fate of a truce monitoring mission. Pania Manikavasagam reports from Sri Lanka.
A bomb blast killed a Sri Lankan top military officer this morning on the outskirts of the island's capital, Colombo. It was the second suicide bomb attack in 3 months. The government said a Tamil Tiger bomber rammed his motorbike into a convoy of military vehicles, killing Major General Parami Kulathunga and 3 others as they traveled to work. The army commander narrowly escaped death in a similar attack in April. Tamil Tiger rebels have denied responsibilities for this morning's attack. Officials say more than 700 people have been killed this year in ambushes and military clashes. Half of them are civilians. The Norwegian truce monitors tasked with observing the 4-year-old ceasefire said Monday's attack is a serious one and the country is fast drifting towards a full scale of war as violence escalates. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Ponnaiah Manikavasagam in Vavuniya, Sri Lanka.
The Supreme Court ruled 5-4 this morning to uphold the constitutionality of capital punishment in Kansas. Today's vote overturns an earlier ruling by the Kansas Supreme Court that found the state's sentencing guidelines favored the death penalty over life imprisonment. President George W. Bush today slammed last week's disclosure of a government program to monitor international financial transactions. Speaking to reporters today, Bush said, quote, "We're at war with a bunch of people who want to hurt the United States of America. And for people to leak that program and for a newspaper to publish it does great harm." Yesterday, Republican Congressman Peter King called for the criminal prosecution of all New York Times staff responsible for the publication of the report about the financial monitoring program. Although 2 other national newspapers ran articles on the program on Friday, the New York Times has received the bulk of Representative King's criticism. The New York congressman, who serves as the chairman of the House Homeland Security Committee, said the Times broke the law and compromised national security by publishing the report. Back in December, the New York Times broke the story of another controversial surveillance operation, that of a massive NSA program to wiretap telephone and email communications without a court order. Lawsuits questioning the legality of the warrantless wiretapping program have already begun. On Friday, government attorneys asked a federal judge in San Francisco to dismiss a lawsuit against AT&T over its role in the government's warrantless surveillance program. The government argued that proceeding with a lawsuit would expose state secrets, thereby putting national security at risk. Government critics say the Bush administration is abusing its powers to avoid embarrassment. Ryan Edwards-Tiekert was at the federal courthouse in San Francisco.
The lawsuit accuses AT&T of giving the National Security Agency access to its customers' communications without a warrant. It's based on allegations by a former AT&T technician named Mark Klein. He says AT&T reconfigured its network in San Francisco and set up a secret room with special equipment capable of diverting and collecting internet traffic for the NSA. Although Klein's statement has already been made public in redacted form, government attorneys argued that giving the allegations a full public hearing could subject AT&T facilities to attack and enable terrorists to communicate more securely. Attorneys for the plaintiffs dismissed those arguments. Rob Fram is an attorney working for the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which brought the case.
We showed the judge the evidence of the mass illegal surveillance by AT&T. We established that it's not a secret. We established that there's no legal basis whatsoever for the United States government to try to take this evidence, which is already in the record, and try and reclaim it as a state secret.
The courts have rejected the state secrets argument only 4 out of the 79 times that presidents are known to have used it. The Bush administration has invoked the state secret privilege at least 24 times, far more than any prior administration. I'm Brian Edwards Tiekert, reporting from San Francisco.
And I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
A top aide to former Secretary of State Colin Powell says he was dismayed on the misuse of national intelligence in the lead-up to the war in Iraq. A committee of Senate Democrats held investigative hearings today on the faulty intelligence claims, FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
Strong words by former Bush administration employees.
I was dismayed. Unquestionably, in my mind, our national leaders were using intelligence in a way that was not as discriminating as it should be. Let me put it that way.
Lawrence Wilkerson was the chief of staff to Secretary of State Colin Powell during the lead-up to the war in Iraq.
The aspect of intelligence in general that disturbs me as a citizen, as a former soldier, is the politicization of that intelligence. What I would call, and what the press has called, cherry-picking, or shaping the intelligence in new and unique ways in order to support political objectives. That's the part of the general comment that I would make about our intelligence community that disturbs me the most.
Wilkerson was referring to the intelligence on aluminum tubes said to be used for a weapons program, and even more so to provide the public with evidence that al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein's Iraq were closely aligned. A special unit was created just to find such evidence, Wilkerson said. Wilkerson was joined by three others who held key roles in the administration in pre-war Iraq. They testified before Senate Democrats on an oversight hearing on pre-war intelligence. Testimony in the hearing not only insisted that sketchy intelligence was misused, but post-war predictions were ignored. Paul Pillar was a national intelligence officer for the Near East and South Asia. He talks about a report of possible post-war problems that went ignored.
The intelligence community produced, on its own initiative, its assessment of the likely challenges there. It presented a picture of a political culture that would not provide fertile ground for democracy and foretold a long, difficult, and turbulent transition. It projected that a Marshall Plan type effort, something on that scale, would be required to restore the Iraqi economy despite the oil wealth. It forecast that in a deeply divided Iraqi society, there was a significant chance that the sectarian and ethnic groups would engage in violent conflict unless an occupying power prevented it. And it anticipated that an occupying force would itself be the target of resentment and attacks, including by guerrilla warfare, unless it established security and put Iraq on the road to prosperity in the very first weeks and months after the fall of Saddam. It also assessed that war and occupation would boost political Islam, increase sympathy for terrorist objectives, and make Iraq a magnet for extremists from elsewhere in the Middle East.
Witnesses said the White House was set on going to war with Iraq at the time of the Downing Street memo revealed such intent between Great Britain Prime Minister Tony Blair and President Bush in July of 2002. And Wilkerson says it was even earlier than that.
As we now know from subsequently reported discussions, very senior figures in the administration who were very much on the pro-war side were, speaking of the overthrow of Saddam as an objective that's now become live in the immediate aftermath of 9/11 in September 2001.
He said the driving and undeterred force behind the policy was Vice President Dick Cheney. But not all members blamed the Bush administration. Blame was also placed on the Congress for lacking oversight and ignoring crimes from a small number of agencies that were skeptical of the evidence. Carl Ford was former Assistant Secretary of State for Intelligence and Research.
It starts with letting us get away with mediocrity. Demand excellence instead. Don't settle for the crap we usually give you. You are blessed with an exceptionally talented workforce, and you have been generous in giving them the resources they need to do their job. Now you must insist that we perform up to our potential and hold us accountable when we don't. Otherwise, the chances we will do better the next time aren't very good.
This is the first hearing the Democratic Policy Committee has held on the issue nearly 4 years after the intelligence claims. No Republican senators chose to attend. But one Republican was present, a member of the House of Representatives, Walter Jones, from North Carolina and critic of the war. A spokesperson for Senator John Kyle, chair of the Republican Policy Committee, said that they are aware of the hearings and will be watching them closely. The hearing consisted of only dissenters to the war policy, none in support. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leon Caldwell.
A massive number of Israeli soldiers backed by military vehicles have gathered on the Gaza border and are poised to enter if an agreement for the release of an Israeli soldier captured by Palestinian militants is not reached. Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert has publicly ruled out negotiating with the captors, who issued a demand today for Israel to release the about 100 women and 300 minors currently jailed. Aside from the soldier that was captured, at least three Palestinian resistance fighters and two Israeli soldiers were killed in the early Sunday morning attack launched by Palestinian resistance groups at the Israeli military post of Kerem Shalom near the southern Gaza Strip. Menarja Breen reports.
The attack was carried out by fighters from three different Palestinian resistance groups, including Al-Qassam Brigade, the armed wing of the ruling Hamas party, the Popular Resistance Committees, and a previously unknown group calling itself the Islamic Army. Abu Ubaida, spokesperson of Al-Qassam Brigade, the armed wing of Hamas, said that this operation came in response to the Israeli policies against the Palestinian people.
This operation is a new non-traditional operation that involved huge security and military preparations. The Zionist enemy is responsible for the results of this operation because it came as a response to Israel's criminal policies and the ongoing killing and assassinations of our people.
About the abduction of the soldier, Abu Ubaida says,
"We have no information or details to release about the Israeli soldier to the Zionist enemy until this moment."
In response, the Israeli army tightened security around the Gaza Strip, while the Navy increased patrols along the Gaza coast in an effort to prevent fighters from smuggling the abducted soldier out of the Gaza Strip. The army also requested that Egyptian security forces seal the Philadelphia route in the southern part of the Gaza Strip and begin additional operations along the borders between the Gaza Strip and Egypt. The army is reportedly preparing for a possible large-scale ground offensive in the Gaza Strip. Dozens of tanks and armored vehicles, infantry corps and engineering corps and other forces have been positioned near the Gaza border since Sunday evening around the Gaza Strip. Saleh Al-Naami, a Palestinian political analyst of the Israeli Affairs, says,
"There is a decision that is already taken by Prime Minister Ehud Olmert himself to carry out a massive operation in Gaza. This operation may include occupying the locations in which the Israeli soldier may be held. We know that Israel had previously threatened to carry out such military operations, even before this recent attack by the Palestinian resistance. Israel had threatened to carry out these operations in response to the Palestinian resistance firing homemade shells on Israel."
The Israeli government held the Palestinian Authority responsible for the safety of the Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit and gave the Palestinians 48 hours to return him. None of the Palestinian factions who took part in Sunday's attack officially claimed responsibility for the abduction of the Israeli soldier. Later on Monday, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas ordered his security services to launch a wide range of searches for the abducted soldier. Israeli Foreign Minister Tzipi Livni held a series of meetings with 60 of international diplomats in an attempt to put pressure on the Palestinian Authority to release the kidnapped soldier. Also, an Egyptian and French mediators took part in the negotiations in this issue. In a statement sent to local Gaza outlets and signed by three resistance groups responsible for the attack, said that they would release information of the soldier if Israel released Palestinian women and minors under 18 years old held in the Israeli jails. At least 123 women and 313 minors are currently held in the Israeli jails. Israel's government reiterated its stance, no negotiations with the Palestinian resistance groups on its soldier. For FSRN from IMEMC.org in Bethlehem, Palestine, I am Manar Jibreen.
Mauritanians voted in a referendum to amend their constitution yesterday to end decades of coup attempts and one-party rule. If approved, it will limit the terms a president can serve in Mauritania, an Islamic republic with Arabs and black populations in West Africa. From Senegal, Njaga Sek has more.
The polls are the first since a military junta led by Colonel Ili Ould Mohamed Val seized the power last August. Now, Mauritania is preparing for presidential elections in May 2007. In neighboring Senegal, many believe it is a political achievement and another step toward reinforcing democracy in West Africa. Aminata Kebe is a Senegalese lawyer.
The referendum in Mauritania is a good thing that we should perpetuate. It reinforces political stability in the sub-region. In countries like Senegal or Gambia that achieved democracy earlier and where we now notice a recession, where journalists are harassed, a referendum like this can incite them to reinforce democracy in their countries.
Last August, the coup ended the authoritarian rule of former President Muammar Ould Sid Ahmed Taya, which lasted for a minimum of 20 years. After the proposed changes to the constitution, no president could be more than 75 years of age or stand for office more than twice, with the mandate to cut terms from current 6 years to 5. In sub-Saharan Africa, many presidents bring amendments to the constitution to lengthen their rule and put their country in danger. Aminata Kebe explains.
Il est temps que les dirigeants africains sachent faire la différence entre la République et la royauté.
African leaders must make the difference between a republic and a kingdom. Staying in power endlessly is a bad thing, and it leads to civil war or rebellion. And we often see in African referendums organized by leaders to stay longer in power. If a referendum is organized after a revolution to reduce the length and the number of terms of the president, it's a good thing to be perpetuated in all African countries.
According to the Mauritanian Ministry of Interior, people massively voted yes, allowing the changes to the constitution. Besides, 70% of registered people voted, but Mauritanians are still expecting more. Those of black descent wanted laws formally abolishing slavery and French to become an official language because Arabic is not widely spoken among the black African community. For FSIN in Senegal, I'm Njaga Sek.
Arizona Senator John McCain's Senate Bill 1003 would finish the relocation process of the remaining Navajo from land on the Black Mesa Hopi Navajo Reservation. The bill passed the Senate unanimously last month and is under consideration in the House Resources Committee. The Navajo, faced with relocation, oppose the bill and say relocation would strip them of their way of life. Since 1974, over 15,000 Navajo and 100 Hopi have been displaced from their ancestral homes in Arizona due to an alleged land dispute between the two tribes. But opponents say that the Navajo are being moved off their land so coal companies can mine it. The Bureau of Indian Affairs estimates that less than a few hundred Navajo remain on Black Mesa, and John McCain's bill would require their imminent removal by 2008. But the remaining Navajo refused to be moved. Christina Honestad reports.
Many Navajo say they are being forced off their coal-rich land so companies can mine it. Opponents of relocation say Attorney John Boyden drafted the original relocation bill, the 1974 Navajo Hopi Land Settlement Act, while it was working for the Hopi Tribal Council and Peabody Coal at the same time. 85-year-old Rena Lane refuses to be moved from her homeland.
This land here was made by Creator, and I have a belief that this is my mother and this is my father. This is my ways of life. I love the land. I have to fight for, and this is the only thing I have besides my culture and my ways of life. I can't go to another place and have a land, and over there, there's nothing free. Where would I go? There's nothing. That's the reason why I have to live here, and that's why I have to fight here.
As Senate Bill 1003 waits in the House Resources Committee, Peabody Coal, the world's largest coal company, waits for a permit to expand their Black Mesa and Kayenta mines into land the Navajo say is theirs. Peabody Coal is a major Bush contributor, according to Public Citizen. Its CEO, Earl Englehart, contributed $100,000 to Bush's 2004 presidential campaign. Englehart later served as an advisor to Bush's 2005 energy plan, which includes a $2 billion investment in the coal industry over the next 10 years. This month, Bush appointed former Peabody Coal manager John Correll to head the Office of Surface Mining, where Peabody is waiting for its permit to expand its two mines. Leonard Benally, a Navajo resistor, says the Navajo are being forced off their land so mineral companies can mine it.
To get at the mineral interests, which was coal, oil, a few people are living off the luxury of the misery and the death of the people out here. Because out here in these hills, we don't have electricity or no running water. But then we own Las Vegas, because all the neon lights and all, you know, the powers that they get for their casinos and all that, the electricity is generated from Black Mesa and Laughlin, Nevada. And then it goes into Southern California.
Peabody Coal has also contributed over $64,000 since 1998 to members on the House Resources Committee, where SB 1003 is waiting for a vote. But both the Hopi and Navajo tribal governments dispute any connection between coal and relocation. The Hopi Tribal Council supports SB 1003, but the Navajo Nation opposes the bill because it would close the Navajo-Hopi Indian Relocation Office, which provides benefits to those who relocate. George Hardeen, spokesperson for the Navajo Nation, says hundreds of families who have relocated have not yet received their benefits. He says there needs to be a program to offset the adverse effects of relocation.
Relocation has resulted in unemployment for a lot of people. It's resulted in alcoholism among many people who never drank before. It's broken up families. It's taken people who have raised livestock their entire lives and placed them in communities where they can't have any livestock at all. It has led to impoverishment, just a dislocation from the land that had been their home for many generations. As a result, it's created great stress, and that's resulted in health problems of all kinds.
At last week's House Resources Committee hearing, Arizona Congressmember Rick Renzi said he is considering alternative legislation to investigate the effects of relocation and continue funding for the displaced Navajo. Meanwhile, the resisting Navajo families at Black Mesa refused to be moved. For FSRN, I'm Christina Onnestad at Black Mesa, Arizona.
The newly established UN Human Rights Council is holding its inaugural session in Geneva. The meeting, set to last through the end of the month, brings together high-level representatives from over 100 countries, many of whom hope that the new council will make its mark on history by adopting, at its first session, the Declaration of the Human Rights of Indigenous Peoples. Despite some progress over the last decade, Indigenous people around the world continue to live in hardship and danger due to the failure of states to uphold their fundamental human rights. Dinuteja Franich reports from New York.
It is estimated that there are 2 million Indians living in the U.S. The Oneida Nation stretches from eastern New York to Buffalo. It represents a population of 50 to 70,000 and is the founding member of the Six Nations Confederacy. Ray Halberer is a representative of Oneida Indian Nation.
Indian nations, they're trying to retain it so they can determine their own futures for themselves. They're constantly in a tension with the state and local and federal governments about their exercise of sovereignty, of protecting their own borders, their land, natural resources, protecting sacred and religious objects, their ability to have education, to preserve their language. It's a constant state of tension.
Many Indian leaders point to the fact that indigenous peoples in America are still uprooted from their lands and communities as a consequence of government policies or private economic interests. Susan Sean Harjo, Cheyenne and Haldalji Muskogee, is the president of the Morningstar Institute in Washington.
Most of our lands were stolen, and so
It's absolutely proper to try to recover property. I'm proud that I've been part of efforts that have resulted in 1 million acres going back to Native nations, including many sacred places.
Indian nations in the U.S. are constantly being denied rights to their traditional lands. Stephen Newcomb is the co-founder of Indigenous Law Institute and representative of Shoshone Nation inhabiting the state of Nevada. He mentions that recently the UN Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination received credible information alleging that the Western Shoshone are being denied their traditional rights to land, while the measures taken by the state may lead to irreparable harm to these communities.
They have a treaty with the United States from 1863, and according to that treaty, their territory consists of some 60 million acres, and the United States government has been attempting to force a payment on them of 15 cents an acre to say, here, you have to take this money, and then you have no more land rights. However, there's no documented evidence that their land had ever been taken from them. The Inter-American Commission on Human Rights also found that the United States is violating the human rights of the Western Shoshone Nation.
The indigenous peoples hope that the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples will finally be adopted by the Council. I'm Danuta Szafraniec, Free Speech Radio News, New York.
People around the country are outraged at proposed energy bills and policies as the House of Representatives embarks on its Energy Week today. Some are calling for real solutions to the energy problems both domestically and internationally. D.C. Radio Co-op's Reem Kakuda has more from Washington, D.C.
Welcome to Wasted Energy Week.
This was supposed to be the time when the U.S. government was supposed to listen to the American people, adds Carl Pope, the executive director of the Sierra Club, at the news conference on the Hill today, whereby five national environmental advocacy groups called for real solutions from the House, trying to appease the popular outrage over increasing oil prices and threats of yet another war. Carl Pope.
The Nuclear Regulatory Commission just licensed in New Mexico a facility for the reprocessing of uranium, which we have indicated we would consider going to war with Iran if they were to undertake the same activities using the same technology.
Meanwhile, the United States House Resource Committee passed an offshore oil and gas drilling bill as a nationwide survey released this week by the Zogby International Polling Firm documents that nearly three-quarters of the respondents say Congress' priority should be passing legislation that promotes renewable energy and better fuel economy for cars.
As Americans prepare to celebrate Independence Day, one thing they won't be cheering is Congress's continued dependence on big oil.
Ana Origo, the legislative director of the United States Public Interest Group, the National Lobbying Office of the State Public Interest Research Groups, says there are solutions to the problem and it's time to implement them.
Many, many, many different economists and scientists have shown through many, many studies that America has the technological know-how to build cars and trucks that can go much farther on a gallon of gasoline. And we should do this, and we should set this in stone by raising gas mileage standards. If we were to get to 40 miles per gallon in 10 years, we could save 3 million barrels of oil a day.
This can save more than the Persian Gulf imports and the potential Arctic National Wildlife Refuge and California oil production combined, adds Origo. Yet United States administration is still pushing drilling bills which ignore environmental concerns and circumvent state and federal legislation, while aggressively promoting nuclear power as a clean non-carbon dioxide energy source. Cindy Shogun of Alaska Wilderness League says that the American public is not fooled by any drilling scams and are mobilized to increase the heat this summer.
And this summer, Americans across the country are going to declare their energy independence. From sea to shining sea, there will be beach events coordinated by the Sierra Club to protect our coastal waters, rig-free all over our coasts. And this Wednesday at over 280 gas stations, citizens will be demanding that Congress be oil-free, and this is a campaign coordinated by MoveOn.org. And then USPERG is demanding that Congress acknowledge and recognize and actually act on global warming, and their Earth on Fire may be in a city near you. And we're going to ask Secretary Kemp Thorne to stay out of the Western Arctic. He's supposed to offer a lease sale in September, and we're telling him no.
With Fred Nguyen of WBAI, I'm Reem Kathuda, dcradiocoop.org.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. From KPFK in LA, I'm Ara Bogado.